We'll kickstart this rain report in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. For the week of December 17th, 2005, this is the Rain Report, formatted for transmitting over repeater and simplex nets and available 24/7 on demand from rainreport.com. I'm Blair Alper, KA9SEQ. How many times have you heard the expression, one man's junk is another man's treasure? The adage applies even to Collins radio equipment, the Cadillac of ham gear for decades. Today, some restored Collins transmitters, receivers, and transceivers still command big bucks on the used market. One Chandler, Arizona ham who knows is Bill Carnes, W7OTQ, a former board member of the Collins Collectors Association and longtime Collins collector.
One of the things that makes Collins very collectible in my mind is the quality of the gear. Collins radio and Collins equipment was always the top of the line. I don't think anyone would argue that. They were certainly the most expensive. For instance, in the mid-50s when they introduced the Goldust twins, the 75A4 and the KWS1, the Goldust twins sold for a little over $3,000. You could buy a nice house in 1954 for $3,000. As a result, there were, relatively speaking, not a lot of them sold. There were more sold than Collins thought were going to be sold. Their introduction strategy for the Goldust twins, for instance, included the ability to buy it as kind of a kit, where you bought the exciter without the power supply for the KWS1, or you could buy the exciter without the PA tubes in it and put in surplus PA tubes. But they found out that that was not necessary, and they withdrew that strategy almost immediately after the introduction. They sold eventually about 1,600 KWS1s, which is a relatively small quantity for a piece of amateur gear. KWS1 was the transmitter part of the Goldust twins. Witness the name, KWS1. It was a single sideband kilowatt input transmitter and was really the first substantial sideband transmitter introduced into the amateur market. I like to restore something that you can substantially restore and basically get back to pretty close to as new condition. Collins, because of the quality of their equipment, the paints and the platings on chassis, for instance, the quality of components was so high, even now, 60, 70 years later in some cases, the platings and the paints are still excellent. It's not uncommon to find a piece of gear that has never been restored that you would rate it a 9.5 out of 10 in terms of plating and paint and the cosmetics. That's the first thing that drives my position on collectability, is they're very, very restorable. If you look at some of what were the middle-of-the-line pieces of equipment manufactured by Hallicrafters, and Hallicrafters made no bones about it. They were the low-to-mid-price spread, and their approach to the market was to build something that was ultimately affordable and that they could be made in volume. The platings and the paints have not held up as well. So that's the first thing that drives me. The second thing is the nature of the company. And you mentioned you were going to do a separate interview on the company itself, so I won't delve into this a lot. But Collins was a very personally driven, family-oriented, very high-quality, people-oriented company. One of the things that I enjoy is not only delving into the electronic history of the equipment, but the people history, who did the designs, who did the production development, the actual people history. And that history for Collins Radio is in my mind enchanting and involves some remarkable people, remarkable engineering work, remarkable innovation. And Collins went on to become not only an amateur radio company, but a leader in avionics, communication, and military equipment, and played a significant strategic role in the winning of World War II. They developed, for instance, the first ability to mechanically, electronically rechannel radios accurately so that, for instance, aircraft that were launched from an aircraft carrier could rechannel their radios in the air if a frequency was compromised. This was a remarkable achievement at the time and involved electrical innovation and mechanical innovation to achieve that, and led to the U.S. having a several-year-long strategic advantage over the Japanese as far as moving frequencies.
We've talked about the exterior of Collins Gear being a major feature for you as a collector. Let's talk about the internal workings of Collins Gear. What were some of the features that make Collins rigs still collectible?
Well, if you look at what it takes to communicate between A and B, which is the ultimate objective of radio, even if you look at one of the more modern current $10,000 transceivers with a prolifera of buttons, displays, et cetera, you know, the ultimate goal is still to communicate. And in order to do that, you basically need reliability, frequency accuracy, frequency settability, and quality signal, low harmonics, quality distortion, and audio. Right from the beginning, going clear back into the 30s, Art and his company focused on that kind of quality. Of course, they didn't achieve some of the goals until into the 40s and 50s when the innovations in linear PTOs, linear VFOs were developed by Collins.
For those who are curious about collecting Collins gear, what rigs are a good value today?
You could approach collecting Collins, I think, economically and with good results by starting into the S-line gear that was developed in the late 50s. The S-line gear is smaller than the A-line gear that was developed in the late 40s and 50s. They're excellent performers, nice to use on the air. They are relatively simple. They're easy to work on, with a couple of exceptions. In a price range where, if you're going to be collecting Collins seriously, it's not a major investment.
You're listening to Hap Holly, KC9RP's interview with Bill Carnes, W7OTQ, an avid collector and restorer of Collins radio gear. We'll be right back. This is the Rain Report.
You're listening to RainReport.com, the only authorized internet source for Rain audio.
The S-Line concept was born with a piece of gear that was not strictly S-Line, with the KWM-1. The KWM-1 was an innovation that came from Gene Senti's basement. Gene was a major player, engineering leader with Collins in the early 50s, and went on to become the director of the amateur radio division. Gene had looked at the 75A4 and the KWS-1, which had individual PTOs. You had to set the PTO of the transmitter against the receiver in order to keep the two on the same frequency. And he had a vision of just having one PTO, and this was the first transceiver ever built. And he went to his basement and took a 75A4 receiver, took it all apart and put it back together again with a few external modules because he couldn't get everything fit in the receiver chassis, built a transceiver that Art came over one night and looked at it and thought, boy, that is really neat, and particularly for mobile operation, that would be great. And he challenged Gene to develop it into a transceiver, which then became the KWM-1, and went on to be a very fine transceiver for both mobile and fixed station operation. Out of that size concept and transceiver concept came the S-Line, which included initially the 75S-1 receiver, the 32S-1 transmitter, the 516F-2 power supply, which was the power supply for the transmitter, and initially a 399C-2 offset VFO. And then they developed the KWM-2A, which was the follow-on to the KWM-1, which became the S-Line transceiver, KWM-2 and KWM-2A. That was the start of the S-Line, was announced in the late 50s and went on to be manufactured through the 60s and 70s. I think they were actually manufactured into the early 80s. There were a few of them made as later models. They rapidly evolved the S-Line from the 75S-1 line to the 75S3 line. There was a 75S2 series, but it was really nothing more than a 75S1 series with expanded frequency ability, which they went on later to use a nomenclature of an A for. So, for instance, in the 75S3 series, the expanded frequency version would have been the 75S3A. Any of that S-line receiver transmitters, 75S1, 2, 3, 3B, 3C, 75S3C, would be a good place to start. They tend to get more expensive, and some of the models that are the later Round Emblem and even Rockwell Emblem receivers and transmitters can get rather expensive. For instance, a Rockwell model or a Round model with the expanded frequency range, a really, really good piece of equipment might run in the $2,000, $3,000, I've even seen them go for $4,000. But you can get into a 75S1 receiver, for instance, for still $300-$400. Transmitters, usually about the same price range. The power supply is built and priced separately. The power supplies have gotten somewhat pricey because when the U.S. government got out of tube gear and they surplused out a lot of S-line equipment, which they used, even though it was built as amateur gear, the quality was so high that they used that equipment a lot in the military. When they surplused them out, for some reason, not a lot of power supplies came out. I think because they were heavy or I don't know what the fundamental reason for that was, but a lot of people went looking for power supplies, and as people have started collecting the S-line, the power supplies have risen in price to where for a very nice power supply now, depending again on whether it's winged emblem, round emblem, Teflon wiring, even Rockwell, you could pay easily $250, $300, $400 for a very nice power supply.
I never owned a piece of Collins gear, although I did borrow at one time a Collins R388 receiver. How collectible is that today?
Oh, a wonderful receiver. They're very collectible, a very nice R388. Can bring $800 to $1,000. On the other hand, you can still find them in the several hundred dollar range. You know, I think you could say, Hap, that almost any of the pieces of Collins gear are pretty collectible. Some of the equipment they didn't make very many of, for instance, the 399C offset VFO that then turned into the 312B4 station control and 312B5 station control and offset VFO. For the S-line, the original 399C2s, they did not make very many of those. Those have become quite pricey. You could pay easily $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 for a very nice 399C. I started out collecting by putting a box so that I have a bit of a tendency to get kind of compulsive about getting collections complete. I started out by putting a box around my collection that I was only going to collect S-line and some A-line over just the winged emblem period, and I wasn't going to try to go back and get all the original models, and I wasn't going to try and go forward and duplicate round emblem and Rockwell emblem. That box did not include military equipment, and so I have relatively few pieces of military gear, and the R390A falls in that category. I do have, because I have let the box out significantly in the area of broadcast gear, and I've become a kind of a dyed-in-the-wool AM-er. I have let that box out, and one of the things I did was let it out to include the R390 because it's such a nice AM receiver. They are very collectible. They have gotten, for a very, very nice one, relatively expensive. A very nice one will probably cost you somewhere in the $1,000 range. You can still buy them in unproven and not so nice condition for substantially less than that, and that's a great place to start and restore one. But they are an absolute marvel of what Collins was excellent at, which was a combination of electromechanical design. The R390 is a huge, huge Swiss watch from a mechanical standpoint in terms of the gearing on the dial and the tuning mechanisms, band switch mechanisms, and it's also a substantially built government quality electrical design. It's a quality receiver, and they don't break very often. When they do, they're a little bit hard to work on, but very, very nice receiver.
What makes them hard to work on?
If you need to get into the mechanical side of it, it's just a lot of gears and mechanical arrangements to take apart and align, and you need to be pretty good not only from an electrical standpoint but from a mechanical standpoint to work on them.
You've just heard part one of a RAIN interview with Bill Carnes, W7OTQ, a Chandler, Arizona ham who had collected and restored Collins radio gear for almost two decades. Bill is also a former board member of the Collins Collectors Association. We'll learn more about collecting and restoring the Cadillac of ham gear from Bill next time in part two of Hap Holly's interview. FYI, our 2000 interview with Michael Krestal, W1RC, talking about the demilitarizing / reclassification of ham gear by the U.S. government will remain on RainReport.com as last week's program file until next weekend, thanks to audio bandwidth being underwritten by CQ Communications. Now for Rain's founder-producer, Hap Holly, KC9RP, I'm Blair Alper, KA9SEQ, enjoying the sights of Chicago, wishing you 73 and 44s from all of us at RAIN, the Radio Amateur Information Network. The RAIN Report is copyright 2005 RAIN, all rights reserved.